Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory.
Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Nathan Connolly.
I'm Ed Ayers.
I'm Joanne Freeman.
And I'm Brian Ballow.
If you're new to the podcast, where the heck have you been? Actually, just kidding. We're really glad you're here.
Each week, we explore a different part of American history and unpack a topic that's been in the news. This week, we wanted to revive an annual favorite, the Backstory Holiday Book Show.
It's our chance to tell you what we've been reading lately and what we've been inspired by over the last year.
This year, we wanted to focus on a particular genre, historical fiction. And what better time than now, when audiences are anxiously awaiting a new film adaptation of Louisa May Alcott's beloved 1868 novel, Little Women.
The story of the four March sisters has already been adapted for the silver screen 6 times, and this latest version is set to hit theaters on Christmas Day. It comes along with a bunch of recent and upcoming history movies, including Harriet, A Hidden Life, and Midway.
Meanwhile, in the world of books, readers have been drawn to historical fiction by a range of authors, including Marlon James, Hilary Mantel, and Essie Adugan. These are authors exploring everything from post-independence Jamaica to Tudor England.
For many people, historical fiction is a chance to read or watch a compelling story and learn a little bit about the past.
But when it comes to these fictions, how much does historical accuracy matter? How useful are novels and movies for teaching history? And how much license does an author have to make stuff up? We'll get into these questions a little bit later. But first, I can't wait. I want to hear what my friends want to recommend to our listeners.
So, folks, I want to recommend a book that's considered to be one of the 100 most important novels of the 20th century by Time magazine. But it may surprise some to learn that it's actually a comic book. It's the book Watchmen. And it was written in 1986 by Alan Moore and art by Dave Gibbons, ink by John Higgins. And it's an incredible example of historical fiction. And I got to tell you, I was drawn back to the book. I had known about it for a long time, but I was really taken to it by virtue of a new iteration of Watchmen that was just produced by HBO and is ongoing. But let me give you a little bit of the backstory of this particular book. Watchmen is basically set in a world that's been utterly changed by the arrival of superheroes. So it's deeply historical, but it's also about an alternative way that history plays out with the arrival of mass vigilantes, and particularly one individual who basically is gifted or cursed with superhuman powers by virtue of an atomic accident. And so what happens in the course of a story that really begins with a murder mystery is an entire redrafting of the 20th century, in effect. You have discussions of the bombing of Hiroshima and the impact of the atomic age. But then there's also a really fascinating counterfactual plotline that runs through, which basically says, if the United States had superheroes, we would not have lost the Vietnam War.
Wow.
Nixon would never have been discovered to have committed scandal during Watergate. He would still be president deep into the 1980s. And because of Nixon's reputation as a mad bomber in this kind of context of the Cold War has now escalated to the point where we are literally at the brink of human annihilation with, you know, the Soviet Union. So the Cold War has taken on an even higher fever pitch than it did in the Reagan era, when obviously, you know, you had the Cold War by most accounts basically end with Gorbachev and Reagan's efforts. So there's a really wonderful way that the book, the novel, the comic, however you want to characterize it, really does look at the nuances of what it means to have superheroes as part of American culture with all of the pros and cons that go with, you know, people's individual imperfections and a society that's still trying to figure it out. But also, it's a really profound way of thinking about what is the absolute worst-case scenario of our atomic obsession and how in some cases, does it take even more dramatic interventions by, you know, sometimes anti-heroes or crazed individuals to basically keep us from the brink of total annihilation, which is how the book effectively concludes. Again, I was drawn back to this book because there's now this series on HBO that is considered by many critical accounts to be one of the most profound treatments of the history of race relations in the country. Mm. And the opening episode focuses on the 1921 Tulsa race riot, or the pogrom against the Greenwood District in Oklahoma. And it was such a dramatic rendering that many people were basically seeing the history of Tulsa at this moment played out for the first time. And the show is doing some incredible things with the history of American politics, with the way in which, you know, groups like the Ku Klux Klan overlap with the police department, the way African Americans basically relied on, you know, their own commercial success to try to secure their own futures. And again, you know, what happens in a country that in our current moment is really still grappling with the legacies of white nationalism. So given what we already know about, you know, the current political situation, you know, revolving around episodes like Charlottesville and, you know, what to do with American immigration policy. This is the kind of show that, again, through fiction, is forcing us to wrestle with what could be some of the conclusions that would come from us not dealing with these questions properly.
So, Nathan, I have to admit, I've not read the book, but I've watched the HBO series, and it just blows your socks off.
Mm-hmm.
Does the series focus on race more than the graphic novel itself?
It does. I mean, it's actually one of the striking oversights of the novel is that given the fact that it's dealing with the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, you would imagine that, say, something like the Civil Rights Movement or voting rights would be foregrounded.
Right.
And it really isn't. I mean, you do get some focus on, you know, the racial contours of the Vietnam War. And ultimately, Vietnam actually becomes the 51st state of the Union as a result of America's win there. And so a lot of what happened subsequently really does kind of tie together the history of race, you know, relations and racial policing in the U.S. to what happens in Vietnam.
I was really struck by an element in the series of a pill that you take that restores you to the memory of the people who'd experienced that. Nostalgia is the name of the pill. And I think for a historian to see that, to be able to take the pill and to be woven into the fabric of history struck me as a really kind of a fantasy and horror show at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. You know, I have to say that this whole, the book slash comic book and the series have not been on my radar screen at all. And I will confess, I somehow vaguely thought, oh, science fiction-y, and thus I will not be interested.
That's why we do this episode,
yes,
Joanne,
indeed.
So you can broaden your horizons.
I am starting my list. it's a reminder of the ways in which different forms of writing and different media can get across different aspects of the historical experience and in different kinds of ways that are equally powerful.
Right.
And why this series now? You know, I hear atomic accident and I think, wow, yeah, right. We used to worry about the atomic age.
Yeah.
But not now.
No. So what was one of the major creative inspirations for this new version was actually the opening of the debate on reparations. Because there is the implementation of a reparations regime under now President Robert Redford, who succeeds Richard Nixon. This is how the story goes.
You're watching it, and it makes sense.
It's true. And so Robert Redford has initiated reparations for the victims of the Tulsa race riot, and that has basically galvanized the movement of white nationalists to basically begin their own kind of assault. And it's again one of those things. I mean, to Ed's point, the way that they're playing with history and the way history is narrated. So, you know, when our colleague in the professorate, Henry Louis Gates Jr., gets to be the Secretary of the Treasury in the show, and he's responsible by way of DNA testing to like distribute, you know, these reparations and such. And so there's a question about history that runs right through this. And Alan Moore, one of the original architects of the Watchmen mythology, he actually has made the argument that Birth of a Nation was the first superhero movie ever made, right? In the way that the narrative played out, you know, the kind of heroism that was attempted to be conveyed by D.W. Griffith. And so this is absolutely a callback to that, you know, particular form of narrative storytelling, but with all of these really important nuances about memory, narration, history, and where the country's future basically lies, whether or not it grapples with these.
Well, Nathan, I'm going to go next just because I'm going to talk about the film made around the same time as your original novel,
okay.
Tin Men, is made in 1987. But it's about Baltimore in 1963. And I'm going to go next because it all feels so small and unimportant and tiny compared to those sweeping themes that you were just talking about. But, you know, I think that's what I love about this film so much. To describe the plot as far as it goes, it's about two tin men, aluminum siding guys, who at the very beginning of the movie have their Cadillacs crash into each other, which begins a feud that takes us through the entire film. But the film is really about colliding worlds. And ironically, these two aluminum siding guys, they occupy the same world. That's a world of white men, individualistic sales guys who, if they don't sell something, they're not worth anything. And they got to drive Cadillacs so that their customers know they're important. That world is colliding with the world of women in 1963. They basically compete for Barbara Hershey. She's married to Danny DeVito, one of the tin men, and Richard Dreyfuss takes her away from Danny DeVito. So one world is this hard-driving, individualistic, materialistic men, and really just one woman, Barbara Hershey, who has feelings. But another world is the world of the market and selling people aluminum siding and the growth of the regulatory state. The film ends with both these tin men being called up in front of the Home Improvement Commission. And in case you don't get the point, you can hear sawing and hammering in the background of these hearings as the regulatory state is being built. And so it's the tension between the individualistic sales guy and this kind of growing, well, regime of security. Barbara Hershey works for the Social Security Administration. And when Richard Dreyfuss goes to see her, he walks in and there is this sea of women. And all of a sudden you realize, oh yeah, there are a lot of women in the workplace, but we don't really notice them because they're in the background. But the movie ends by looking at the future. And the future is two things. One, clearly, are these Volkswagens that keep showing up, right? And Richard Dreyfuss is looking at these Volkswagens, even though he drives a Cadillac. And the movie's saying, you know, values are really shifting. And then this is controversial. I've looked at this five times. But I would argue that it also ends, the last shot, could be a large piece of metal rising out of Baltimore Harbor in the distance. But I think if you look at it the right way, it's the McDonald's arch. And there's a sense of nostalgia and sense of loss for these guys doing these scams out there, hustling, being replaced by the security of Social Security Administration, by this kind of corporatization of everything in McDonald's. But there's definitely a positive valence of the challenge for Richard Dreyfuss shifts from selling aluminum siding to expressing his emotions. What Richard Dreyfuss is worrying about at the end is, how do I actually tell this woman I love her? And I think in one year, in one place, this captures one of the most important cultural changes, one of the most important political changes over a couple of decades of American history, small bore though it may be.
You had me at regulatory state, Brian.
That's what usually wins people over.
Joanne, the stakes are rising here. What do you got?
Boy, I'm coming from a very different place than Nathan.
You don't have many films made in your time, do you?
That's right. So darn. I can't go there. But actually, I am going to a film. In a way, it touches on a little bit about what Brian and Nathan were both talking about. The film I want to recommend, and I'm going to hedge it in with all kinds of bizarre qualifications, is the 1975 Stanley Kubrick film, Barry Lyndon. Now, it's a film that is basically like a kind of picaresque tale that follows along with the title character, who starts out as kind of a farm boy and who uses the military and then a very advantageous marriage to kind of raise himself into the English aristocracy.
There is this Ryan O'Neill?
Yes, indeed. It is Ryan O'Neill is the star character. It's a three-hour-long movie. It's a three-hour-long, slow-moving movie. It was at the time called by at least one critic a coffee table movie. But it's
honestly, Joanne, I've seen coffee tables move a lot faster.
Yes, but the thing that I love about it and the reason why I'm bringing it up here is while it's a very prettified version of the past, what it does amazingly is get at a kind of sensory visual understanding of the past in a way that not a lot of films do and not even all historical fiction does. There are a lot of scenes in it that were filmed around candlelight, and apparently Kubrick got a special kind of a lens created so that he could actually not use electric lighting and only use the candlelight to film these scenes. And what you get from that is people huddled around the light, you know, the intimacy of a candlelit universe as opposed to a universe where you take lighting for granted. So there are so many things in that movie that are sensory and not even necessarily spoken, but that get at something about the past in a way that I think as a historian, that kind of movie and that movie particularly for me is kind of an intellectual reminder that that kind of evidence and that kind of understanding matters in the way that we think about history. That film, despite the fact that it may or may not be a coffee table movie, is so sensory. It captures something so beautifully that I haven't seen that movie for years and years, but I could probably recreate for you many scenes of it that just grasp something about the late 18th century that really stuck with me.
How do you capture that as an historian? Or how have you in your work specifically?
One way that I did that recently, I was writing about Congress. I went and found climate reports on what the climate was like in the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Wow. And the climate frosty, no doubt.
No, indeed, quite the opposite. You know,
a lot of hot air, actually. Yeah.
Stinky, smelly. I don't remember how many degrees hotter always on the inside than whatever it was outside. I mean, it was a very detailed account of precisely what it felt like. And boy, when you have that understanding, you're not thinking about a bunch of highfalutin individuals in a hall of Congress, you know, spouting off ideas. You're thinking about a bunch of people in a room that's really unpleasant and smelly, arguing with each other and banging each other around, trying to get what they want.
Wow.
And that's closer to reality.
That's really interesting, too. Gosh, even though I'm kind of conducting this conversation, I'm not sure why I let myself go last.
I'm looking at a stack of books. Don't tell me we're going to have to listen to something about books.
Well, we are going to, because, you know, as soon as I heard what our assignment for today was, I knew what I wanted to read, which was Ta-Nehisi Coates' new book, Water Dancer, which I knew was, because he's been so important over the last few years, such a powerful voice. I was curious to see how someone would translate his nonfiction approach, autobiographical approach, to fiction.
Right.
And it's about slavery, and it's about, not to give too much away, the possibility of escape from slavery. And when I read that, it made me remember that there's been a whole cluster of books recently that are reimagining this crucial period that I think about of slavery, Civil War, and Reconstruction in a a bold way. I think of Colson Whitehead's book, The Underground Railroad, in which he actually imagines an underground railroad. And that reminded me of another book, The Good Lord Bird, which is another prize-winning book. All of these things have knocked the doors off the prizes by James McBride, which imagines John Brown's raid told from the viewpoint of a boy who's mistaken for a girl and accompanies Brown on all these adventures and seeing Frederick Douglass and all these kinds of things. And I realized that these kind of fit together as a representation of this crisis of slavery and of the nation that I've never seen before. And I was wondering why in the last few years, suddenly, these very heavy topics have elicited these imaginative approaches. And kind of makes me think, Nathan, about what you're saying. In some ways, you look at something like the violence in Tulsa in 1921. In some ways, having some kind of device other than straight reportage sort of allows you to kind of get around it, to see it in more dimensions or something.
Well, and to confront difficult issues with the distance of fiction so that the ugliness can be there. But on the other hand, it isn't straight fact.
Yeah, and I think that all the books that I mentioned certainly don't shy away from the horrors of slavery. They're all viscerally powerful. But at the same time, they hold up a kind of redemption or that makes it almost possible to think about the horrors that they're describing. Yeah. So I don't know what it is about the last few years that would lead such divergent authors, such powerful authors, to take this approach. I don't know, Nathan, going back to yours, is it something about the impact of, say, graphic novels or of science fiction that people can see the power that's inherent in those other genres?
Well, part of what I think is pretty tremendous, I mean, you talk about Ta-Nehisi Coates. I mean, you know, his essay that, on the case for reparations is partly what prompted the relaunch of Watchmen, right? Just to be very clear.
Right.
He's also someone who has written comic books under the kind of Marvel banner. And, you know, they've been around the character Black Panther, which had its own, obviously, blockbuster, you know, resonance recently in film. But if you read those Coates comic books, he's actually citing historians. He's actually named, you know, one sequence of stories, A Nation Under Our Feet, after the Steve Hahn, you know, book. Another one, Avengers of the New World, after the Laurent Dubois book. And Edmund Morgan's scholarship literally appears in the pages of the comic. No BS. It's like a book handed between characters in this fictional world, right? And so to your point, Ed, I think there's actually something happening where people are using these various media as a way to actually improve our historical literacy, right? I mean, I think it's a really important way of saying, okay, I mean, to even Joanne's point about Barry Lyndon, like, what is it about being able to reconstruct a moment at an affective level or at the level of the sensory that can, you know, bring people to Edmund Morgan's work later on as a book or bring me back to, you know, reading the old Alan Moore comic and from the mid-80s. I mean, there's got to be
a
way.
Door.
Yeah, exactly. Like a door between this new form of communication that's actually built on top of a really important literary foundation, which I think is not incidental. Temperature is personal. Everyone's idea of comfortable is unique. Now, my wife and I are dramatically different temperatures, and so it's constantly a struggle in the car, at home, trying to figure out who needs to be hot or who needs to be cool. And it basically contributes to a whole lot of extra drama around the house. Now, not feeling thermally comfortable can contribute to all kinds of things: lost productivity, increased stress levels, and can be mentally exhausting. Ember Wave is there when you need relief most. All you do is press to activate Ember Wave for a burst of heating or cooling. This sensation pairs with your body and mind to make you feel more comfortable in a matter of minutes. Ember Wave provides comfort in unpredictable climates, relief from stress, and can support sleep. Invented by three MIT scientists, Ember Wave was named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. And has been reviewed by a number of leading technical publications like Wired, Fast Company, and GMA. For the Black Friday Cyber Monday sale, listeners get $60 off if they go to emberwave.com/backstory. That's EmberWave.com/backstory.
So now that we have some of our favorite works of historical fiction on the table, let's pull the lens back or turn the page, in your case, Ed, the old-fashioned page, and try to understand a little bit about how some of us came to this genre in the first place. I'll be the first to say I've still don't know that I've ever read a work of historical fiction, but I'll bet some of you have from an early age, and I'd love to hear about your early encounters with the genre in any genre, film, books, whatever, comics, Nathan.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I was lucky enough to have a series of illustrated condensed classics that were kind of sold as a big volume set where you have, you may remember these, you know, one page of text, one page of image, you know, and it was, you know, James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans, it was Moby Dick, it was Oliver Twist. And so
classics
again,
classics illustrated, right?
That's the one. That's the one. Exactly. Classics Illustrated. And I mean, that was my go-to right there, basically between the ages of like 8 and 12, you know. And I loved reading those books, and the illustrations were fantastic. Every one of those works, I mean, is basically a form of historical fiction, right? I mean, it was an introduction to, you know, New Bedford, Massachusetts, but on the deck of the, you know, the Pequod, which is obviously a very different way of thinking about whaling and a whole host of things. And, you know, and I wasn't going to read Moby Dick as, you know, a 9-year-old. And so I have
No, you didn't read it till you were 10, as I recall.
So it was absolutely, again, a kind of door for me to think about.
Well, that's what I was about to ask. Yeah. What did it lead to? What was it a door to?
So it was a door to storytelling for me as a young writer and thinking about, you know, history. It was a door to going back to antiquity and looking at, you know, books like the Odyssey, which I got kind of really wrapped up in. Again, it's fictional, but it's obviously a text that's deeply rooted in that part of the world and its history. It allowed me, frankly, to develop a kind of focus that then let me sit through, you know, longer form storytelling, right? Especially when you think about, you know, me as a latchkey kid, and I was, you know, watching a lot of, you know, TV. It was public TV, like Reading Rainbow and, you know, 3-2-1 Contact. But it still was a way for thinking about the book as a form that I could really get swept up into.
Ed, Joanne, did you guys have early encounters with historical fiction?
I have a really specific one. I don't know what it says about me that it's actually not a book, but a movie. And this is going to be the sort of utter cliche that I'm going to utter here. But the fact of the matter is that the movie that first made me, I think about history at all was the movie 1776. Once again, I will say it's not the world's best movie. It's a little awkward and a little goofy.
Is it a musical?
It is indeed. Years ago, when I would say to my class, hey, we're going to have a movie night and we're going to watch 1776, and it's a musical about the Declaration of Independence, they would howl with laughter, and now they don't laugh anymore. It's old hat now, cliche. Right. But what it did, in addition to all the things it doesn't have and all the ways in which it's inaccurate, but what it did for me as a kid was it brought history literally to life. These weren't sort of highfalutin characters. These were very real people. They were funny. They were flawed. It made history human to me, and it made the story of, you know, what we now call in all capital letters, the founding, made that contingent, introduced the ways in which that wasn't an of course when it happened, that it was something that had to be figured out and people had different views. So I saw that movie and all of a sudden I felt like, oh, like, wait a minute, who are these people? And I went to the library and started reading biographies because I wanted to know who the people were. So, you know, I think that's one thing that good historical fiction of any kind can do is really humanize the past and reintroduce, if it's been lost, contingency.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
I don't know if it's because I came to this later than you folks or that I'm a lot smarter, but my introduction to all of this was...
I could answer that question, Ed, but I'm not going to.
is The Grapes of Wrath, a classic high school assigned reading, even though I'm not sure that it was. And I can just remember that feeling of being washed over by the power of that story. And, you know, I ended up sort of becoming a historian that tries to include everybody in the story. And I remember thinking, here is a book about really poor people who don't really have much control over their lives. And they're so... I care so much about what happens to them. I think that I fell in love with history and writing at the same time through that book. I had the good fortune of working in a bookstore for $1.25 an hour through the latter years of high school and the first year of college. And during slow times, I was there with all of the great paperbacks of the late 60s, early 70s, and sort of sampling these, careful not to break the spine when I'm reading these little books, and realizing there was a whole world of imagination that I'd give anything to be a part of.
Well, I was going to ask you all how your introduction to history has affected the kind of historian you are. And I'll start off with a confession. You've really answered that question, Ed. I'll start off with a confession that I think I'm the kind of historian until very recently never wrote about people because I didn't read historical fiction, because I didn't associate history with people, with characters, or with what today we would call social history or cultural history. And I think I missed a lot by not being introduced to history through the kinds of characters that Joanne was talking about, through that kind of compassion for poor people that you encountered in your reading, Ed. But I'm curious to hear your own self-reflections. I hope they're confessions as well about the kind of historians you are as a result of your encounters with historical fiction.
Well, I mean, I think in my case, it feels as though there's a really obvious connection because the kind of history that I do, I may be a political historian, but what I'm really interested in is the human experience of politics.
Right.
The culture of it and the cultural logic of it and the emotion of it. And in a sense, that's precisely the kind of stuff that drew me into history in the first place. I just wanted to understand who these people were and why they did the things that they did, particularly, and it's particularly as a kid, but still remains true today, things that they did that didn't make sense to me. You know, so when I got older, that became, how does dueling make sense? Like, how does that possibly make sense? Why do people do that? I want to understand that. But I think that the human perspective and trying to look through the eyes of other people and understand why they're doing things that don't seem logical and how that shapes politics, that in a way, I can sort of trace that all the way back.
Yeah. Nathan?
So I think for me, my early reading actually helped me not be so wed to history having a happy ending. Some of the stuff that, again, I was, curling up with, Moby Dick is not really a happy ending. The Last of the Mohicans is a pretty depressing, story. And I think for me as a writer, I absolutely try to capture, complexity and transformation and, another C word, contingency, right? That kind of stuff is really important without losing sight of the fact that these are worlds still populated by people. So that balance of having the kinds of stories where people are operating with, imperfect information or maybe personal obsessions or, at some point where the story just can't end happily because too much has already happened. That was basically part of how I decided to tell a story about a neighborhood being demolished by an interstate highway, right, in my first book. I mean, that's not a story that you can wrap up with a bow, but it's one that in its telling you can actually help to make really human and at least felt by the reader. And so, for me, not being caught up in a way that I think Hollywood films oftentimes went, at least for the films that were directed at my age, like the G and the PG movies, right? But, the stories and the novels, the historical fiction, they oftentimes ventured a little bit more complexity and oftentimes a bittersweet conclusion.
Well, we've certainly fallen in love with historical fiction. Are there dangers? How about the A word, accuracy?
So this is one that I saw a lot of attention paid toward Harriet when it came out as a film, and there are characters that were introduced that might not be historical. And it's interesting, when I think about Watchmen in particular and why I was so drawn to it, it's the truest depiction I've ever seen of the Jim Crow South, or the Jim Crow problem, I should say, politically. The film gets it right on things like
right.
the political meaning of lynching. The film gets it right in terms of the way that the Ku Klux Klan was deeply embedded in urban life in the 1940s and had to basically be rooted out, you know, of police departments. That was actually a thing. And so even if you have fictional characters who are populating this world, it is able to achieve an honesty and an accuracy, again, at the level of how the history works, how transformation mm-hmm. happened, how the institutions behaved, that to me felt absolutely brilliant. And so I wasn't, and it's not invested in, you know, retelling the story of Richard Nixon in the most accurate way, right? So I think there's a way to approach, at least for me, the best historical fiction is stuff that doesn't try to be factually accurate as much as be emotionally or institutionally or relationally true.
But, you know, in the case of what you're talking about,
yeah.
that's something that's clearly, Watchmen is something that's clearly not factual,
right.
President Robert Redford.
Right.
But, you know, I'm thinking about the obvious contender here when you're talking about accuracy versus impact, and that's the musical Hamilton, which uh-huh. isn't so obviously fictional,
right.
is grounded on a lot of history, does have a lot of things in it that are accurate, but obviously also leaves a lot of things out. It's hardly, I wouldn't assign it for my students to learn about history. And the historical community of early Americanists has kind of fallen into one of two camps on it. And some think it's so powerful and so influential culturally. It's acted, again, this idea of the door. It's been a door for many people, but the door
right.
that they walk through actually is sort of leading them into a 21st century version of the past that it's hard to teach against.
Mm.
To me, it so captured, in a sense, it did for a new generation what 1776 did for me, which is restore the humanity and the contingency of particularly that time period, that yes, with all of the inaccuracy, to me, that becomes a teaching opportunity. So I see that as a door that one can use as a teacher and otherwise to take advantage of, you know, to be quite frank, an interest that wasn't necessarily fully stoked before. It's not that, so
right.
people wander around with a vast fascination with early America. But there's a very good point to be made that people see that musical and then they assume that everything that they saw in it is true because, hey, you know, Washington's farewell address is in it. And so how, all of you guys, what's your sense of how do you deal with history that walks that line in a more delicate kind of a way?
Mm.
You know, I think all history walks that line, whether it's fiction or the nonfiction that we write. You know, I remember, Nathan, watching Watchmen and seeing the terrifying scenes of airplanes in 1921 buzzing
right.
The African-American neighborhood in Tulsa. And I actually looked it up. Oh, come on. And there were.
Yeah.
There were biplanes
yeah.
that
no, yeah.
were
tossing sticks of dynamite down, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, you know, a fact matters, right? On the other hand, it does annoy me that writers of fiction and filmmakers sometimes give up the inherent drama of what's mm-hmm. true for something they feel they have to manufacture.
Right.
And thinking about the suite of representations of the Civil War that I was talking about before,
right.
the Lincoln movie, he could have met Frederick Douglass. And instead, they have two made-up African-American soldiers
right.
listening to a speech. And then it's like, what was the point of that when you could have actually represented the struggle that actually happened, right? So I guess my only comments, Brian, would be I think that we're not nearly as hung up on accuracy as people out in the world imagine that we are, in the sense that, you know, we don't lack a sense of humor or a sense of how a story is constructed. On the other hand, I do think this kind of cavalier idea that it's okay to make stuff up because history itself is just not that interesting is misguided.
Right.
Yeah. What's true is more interesting than something made up if you can unlock it.
Right. Yeah, and I find my answer to my own question surprises me, but the kind of inaccuracies that bother me the most are those in service of a thesis or an agenda. That's what we're supposed to have as scholars, a thesis, an argument.
Yep.
My example is another film. It's Oliver Stone's JFK, which pays great attention to getting the costuming right and gets a lot of facts right, but it leaves out a lot of facts in service of a conspiratorial thesis.
Right.
And the huge argument is everything went to hell in the handbasket as soon as JFK was assassinated, right? So that's kind of an agenda. So I want to end on an upbeat note and prove to you that I have read at least
Apparently, you've not read enough Classics Illustrated.
But I want to prove to you that I've read at least one novel. And that's Graham Greene's Quiet American, which I have assigned to classes. Obviously, I talk about it being fiction, but it gets at just the very things that all of you have talked about, which are human figures and relationships. It's that ability to portray the insensitivity of Americans in another culture in Vietnam that really comes through in that novel better than any work of scholarship on Vietnam that I know and that I couldn't imagine capturing in a scholarly way. I do think fiction writing, I think films, I think music, I think painting, and I could go on with the arts. I think that they can get at things that we simply can't get at by hewing strictly to the facts.
Or touch you on levels that reading a nonfiction book can do but doesn't necessarily have to do. But but these arts that are using history and deploying history and presenting history can get you on either a sensory or an emotional level to have a different kind of understanding than facts can provide.
Sometimes even a podcast.
Let's all get carried away, Brian. If you're curious about what books we recommended in 2018, head over to our website, backstoryradio.org, to check out last year's book show.
Well, that's going to do it for us today, but you can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of the episode, or ask us your questions about history. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org, or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio.
Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.